You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When the House voted on August 1, 2011 to raise the debt ceiling limit, it marked the end of months of rounds of intense political negotiations. In his latest book, Bob Woodward gives us a detailed account of the talks that led up to the last-minute deal which pulled the American economy back from the brink, and he explains what the debate over the debt ceiling reveals about Washington today. Mr. Woodward has written 17 books. His latest, which is published by Simon & Schuster, is called The Price of Politics, and I'm very pleased that it brings him back to our show. Hello.
Thank you.
The book starts before President Obama had even taken the oath of office. Was this debt ceiling debate looming over his administration from day one?
No, it was not, because for the first 2 years of his administration, the Democrats controlled both the House and the Senate, and so that changed. And that's when the Republicans started saying, okay, we're going to negotiate on this to get some of the things they wanted, they hoped, namely spending cuts. But the book deals not just with the intense period on the debt ceiling, which is the authorization to borrow trillions more.
Which Republicans had always voted for in the past.
Yes, that's right. And the John Boehner, the new Speaker of the House, beginning in 2011, said, this is leverage, and we're going to use it. And, of course, it was leverage that the Democrats had tried to use successfully the year before to get the Simpson-Bowles Fiscal Commission appointed. So it covers the whole 3.5 years and actually takes it up to what we're dealing with right now, which are automatic spending cuts and tax increases coming. But I think what people don't quite realize, if I can bore you for a moment with this, because it's a big hurricane coming our way, and that is in about 4 or 5 months, whoever's president, Obama, Romney, is going to have to go to the Congress and say, I need authority to borrow trillions more. The Congress, who's ever there, is going to see that as a lever to get some things. And that was what happened in 2011, and we almost defaulted on our debt, which would have created a catastrophe, as the Treasury Secretary told President Obama, perhaps worse than the 30s depression.
Now, both sides are blaming the other for the automatic spending cuts. Republicans are saying that President Obama is going to cut the military. He's saying, well, it's not my fault. This is just part of that law that I had no control over.
Yes. I mean, actually, what happened, which is laid out in great detail, the latter part of last year that led to this, what they call sequestration, awful word, but it is mandated cuts in defense, security, and in other areas. And what happened, is these negotiations were going on. David Plouffe, who was Obama's campaign manager in 08, is now in the White House as the political advisor, has the office closest to the Oval Office, and the book shows the tremendous influence he has. Plouffe realizes, oh my God, the Republicans are willing to throw defense under the bus because they do not want tax increases at any cost. And so they threw defense under the bus, but in so doing, everything got thrown under the bus. We're going to have a series of mandated cuts that are truly mindless.
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 Just because they're automatic.
Because they're automatic and there's no flexibility. Now, Congress could change the law, but you know, to reach agreement on this is difficult to impossible. I mean, let's take an example. In the area of biomedical research, which is something the United States has been way ahead on, billions that have been spent on it led to the advances that have been made in AIDS, HIV work, and so forth, will mandate cuts at National Institute of Health such that the grants that are given out to researchers are going to essentially be cut in half. And that's the future biomedical research. It's something the United States has shined in for 60 years, and so let's just arbitrarily cut it in half. Makes no sense.
And what are the arguments the people who are continuing along this road are giving us?
If you say that
this is going to cause incredible cuts in biomedical research, are they saying, well, the private sector will just pick up the slack?
No, they're not. I mean, this is why there's such hysteria about it, and there should be. And this is the result of the inability of Congress to reach an agreement on these matters. And, you know, this is last year's history, but it's important. The super committee was set up of Democrats and Republicans to come up with $1.2 trillion in cuts, and everyone was sure. Harry Reid, the Democratic leader, this is going to work. Speaker Boehner, the Republican leader in the House, absolutely, this is guaranteed. And then when it got down to the negotiations, they couldn't agree on a dollar's worth of cuts or tax increases, so they just postponed it. In the postponement, they are taking this country to a moment of series of moments of economic peril that absolutely make zero sense.
Now, the last time this happened, when Republicans paid a price for being blamed for bringing us to the brink, are they concerned about paying the price again?
This is Newt Gingrich in the 90s and so forth. That was about shutting down the government, which occurred and was didn't work. And then they eventually, Clinton and Gingrich, cut deals. In this case, what really is at risk is shutting down the economy. And it's not if that happens, if we have a government-induced, government-created recession, God help us. I mean, they're not going to be able to blame Republicans or Democrats. I mean, one reader of this in detail said, what this shows, you've taken on the Democratic establishment and the Republican establishment and shown and demonstrated meeting after meeting, phone call, memo after memo, that neither of them is working, and the impulse is to vote out all the incumbents and start afresh.
Although that's not going to happen, as we know.
Yes, I think that's right.
Did the negotiations over the $787 billion spending package in early 2009 reveal some of the dynamics that would play out in the summer of 2011?
It did. This was the famous stimulus package, and the Republicans actually wanted to participate and offered, granted, as you would expect, tax cuts, but there were tax cuts in the Obama stimulus, and they just sidelined the Republicans, and probably unwisely, Rahm Emanuel, who was Obama's chief of staff then, had a philosophy of, we have the votes, blank you. And so the Republicans were alienated and not brought into the process. And to a certain extent, the Obama White House is responsible for creating the new Republican majority in the House.
Although President Obama promised a bipartisan approach, but you're suggesting that they really weren't open to any of the ideas that the Republicans came to them with?
They weren't. And
Rahm Emanuel, the Chicago Teachers Union, will tell you, does have a combative style.
Oh, he sure does. It's fierce. And now, that's not the whole story. I mean, the Republicans are inflexible on lots of things. And as I say, they're a brick wall. The problem here is presidents often have a brick wall to deal with, and you have to find a way to tear it down or go around it.
But in this case, the Republicans also are split. We have Eric Cantor, who represents the new breed, and John Boehner, who represents the older,
that's well said,
more pragmatic breed, although he has been forced to be more hardline than one might have expected.
Well, it was actually Boehner who, and you're right. I mean, Cantor's the new breed, and let's label it as it is. It's the Tea Party infused. We are not going to grow government. We are not going to let there be any tax increases. And Boehner is a conservative, more pragmatic. He was the one, as I show, who told the president, you know, let's sit and meet and let's come up with some agreement on this in 2011. And Boehner, to his credit, said the only way we can do this is through tax reform, which is what Simpson Bowles proposed, and some sort of entitlement reform. The breakdown of those agreements I chart meeting by meeting, sometimes hour by hour, and it's a shame. And it was some of the key conversations, negotiating moments were on the telephone, which made no sense.
My guest is Bob Woodward. His latest book, The Price of Politics. Well, there were also there wasn't cooperation between Cantor and Boehner, and that
there's
led
a
to
war actually.
And you would think that the Republican whip and the at that time minority leader of the House would be working in tandem.
Well, this is in the first 2 years. Then, of course, when Boehner became the speaker and Cantor the majority leader, there's a scene in the book where Boehner has been asked by the president to consider more revenue, and he calls Cantor down to his office on the second floor in the Capitol. And it's one of those moments you find hard to believe because Cantor's chief of staff, a man named Steve Stombrais, who's a former Army intelligence officer, bald head, very aggressive, asks the speaker, said, how many votes do you think you'll get for that? And the speaker said, about 170 Republicans. And Cantor's chief of staff says, you're crazy. And Cantor backs up his chief of staff and says, essentially, you'll only get 50 votes.
Was he right?
I think he was right. But the vision that Boehner had and the vision that Obama had was if they, the two leaders, the Democratic leader, the president, and the Republican leader, could reach agreement, go before the microphones and the cameras and say, this is going to be painful, everyone's going to have to give on something, that the momentum and the authority of their offices would carry it over the finish line. Well, we'll never know because we didn't get there.
Well, did President Obama's decision to pursue health care reform effectively sideline the debt ceiling issue for a couple of years? Was he using up his political capital that he brought into the White House when he was elected?
Well, he indeed focused on health care, and there's some people who think that it was the wrong focus. But the debt ceiling issue and that authority to extend was not on the table in 2009, 2010, really, until the end when, as I was saying, the Democrats used it as leverage to get Simpson Bowles appointed.
Well, the economy and government spending are the two biggest issues in this campaign. Was the campaign one of the reasons Republicans were so unwilling to hand Obama an easy win?
Yes. And when I interviewed the president just a couple of months ago for this book, he said people came into the Oval Office and to his face told him, if we work a deal on this, it will guarantee your re-election.
And Mitch McConnell announced at the day the president was elected that it didn't matter what he did, that it was a job of the Republicans to ensure that he wouldn't be reelected.
That's correct.
That was a warning.
Yes, it is a warning, and not. I mean, he put in English what politicians feel about the other side. But in that interview, interestingly enough, he also said, "I don't want Obama to fail. I want him to change." And that somewhat mitigates the point.
Bob Woodward is my guest. He is an associate editor at the Washington Post, where he's worked for 41 years, and he's shared two Pulitzer Prizes, first for the Post coverage of the Watergate scandal, later for the coverage of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. His latest book, The Price of Politics, it's published by Simon & Schuster. Stay with us for more. We are back with Bob Woodward. His latest book is called The Price of Politics. It's published by Simon & Schuster.
we were talking just a moment ago about Barack Obama's appearance on the show when he was still a senator, junior senator from Illinois, and he came across as very warm and very different from the man who I have seen in the White House. Has something changed, or was I missing something at the time?
Okay, well, when I talked to him a couple of months ago for this book at great length with very specific questions, he was warm and responsive and so forth. The problem is he doesn't connect with people that he needs to connect with. The New York Times had a story a couple of days ago about the Arab leaders don't feel they know or connect with Obama.
Despite the fact that he's often accused of siding with them.
Yes, but it's not personal. It's kind of bureaucratic. The Democratic and Republican leaders, I mean, the Democratic leaders he don't have that sort of relationship with him. And there's a scene in the book where Harry Reid, the leader in the Senate, Democrat from Nevada, goes in with his chief of staff to the president when talks on debt ceiling have collapsed or about to collapse, and the chief of staff is the one who tells the president to his face in the Oval Office, "I'm disappointed in this White House in you for not having a plan B, a fallback option on all of this." And afterwards, Harry Reid says to his chief of staff, "You did a good job." He needed to hear that. He's not hearing that from anyone. Now, why isn't the Democratic leader in the same party have the sort of relationship with Obama's that he can deliver that bad news, that kind of direct talk?
Now, is it totally Obama's fault, or is it also the people he surrounded himself with?
Well, there's a scene in the book where the head of IBM talks to Rahm Emanuel and says, "You know, you are screwed up here in this White House. You do not have a COO, a chief operating officer, somebody to get things done, to execute." Speaker Boehner made the same point to me at great length, said under Obama, it's not clear who's in charge. And the book shows that the powers are divided among the congressional relations people, the budget people, and the political people.
He said there's a lack of process.
Yeah, and Obama is exquisitely tuned into his own ambivalences, if you get what I'm trying to say. Obama's very smart. He's a progressive Democrat. But he realizes, my God, we have to get controlling of this spending binge we're on. And so he kind of goes back and forth. And it's not clear to what port he is sailing. That is true of people in the White House, of people in his own party, and the Republicans on the Hill.
Well, is the Obama White House not very good at smoothing ruffled feathers at the beginning, or didn't it seem to care if a few feathers got ruffled?
Well, it depends on whose feathers. You need to have the relationship. One of the models for this is Ronald Reagan when he was president, and Tip O'Neill, the Democratic Speaker of the House. They did a deal on Social Security, which was, almost inconceivable, raising the employment tax and also cutting back on some of the benefits, but they agreed they wouldn't challenge each other. They did tax reform. And
George Mitchell told me he had a similar kind of arrangement with Bob Dole. He said that they agreed to disagree on almost everything, but not to get personal about it and not make it into a public spat. And that's not the way it is today.
It isn't. And the loser is every voter, or even people who don't vote in this country. And we have taken this to the brink in a dangerous way. And as I reported this and traveled the road of spending hours and hours in the White House and on the Hill and talking to people involved in this, trying to get the granularity of exactly what happened, it suddenly dawned on me that we are on a course that is not rational. And that's why it's called the price of politics, because everyone runs to their political solution rather than the large generic solution for the country.
After the 2010 midterm elections, Paul Ryan became the chair of the House Budget Committee and released his own budget proposal. How did the president react when he read that plan for the first time?
Well, he was quite upset because he felt it was a dark view of America and cut some things. But then the Ryan budget, which proposed $4 trillion in deficit reduction, the president himself, who would initially last year only proposed $1 trillion, came out with a $4 trillion plan. Now it was, both the Ryan and the Obama plan have holes in them.
And his plan is very long-term as well.
Yeah, the president's is 12 years instead of 10 years and so forth. But they're all, when you get into and start looking at some of these things, there's an inexactness that to a certain extent is necessary. But you can't just have your plan and the other guy's plan. You got to sit down and say, okay, well, it's the Joe Biden way, which I lay out in great detail in the book. Biden works with the people on the Hill, and the rule is one for you, one for me.
Well, Biden was in the Senate for a long time. Barack Obama was in for only one term. So Joe Biden understands how that works better. And is he doing the same sort of thing that Lyndon Johnson did when he was, he was also frustrated as vice president, if you read Robert Caro's book, but he had that ability to get people in Congress to do things that some others could not do.
Yes, and sometimes Johnson would resort to strong-arm tactics. You'll do it my way or else. Biden certainly does not do that. He does. It's more, I understand where you're coming from, understand where I'm coming from. We need a little of both sides. And it's a shame that in all of these discussions and negotiations and all of the lawmaking over 3.5 years, even some minor, what's the reality? They didn't cut anything. They did not cut. They did not raise taxes on anything, and it's this avalanche waiting to descend on us in January.
Bob Woodward is my guest. His latest book, "The Price of Politics," published by Simon & Schuster. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, the president heavily criticized Ryan's plan in a speech in April 2011, and Paul Ryan was there. Did the president know that he was going to be there?
No, he didn't. And when I asked the president about this, he said that was a mistake, and to his credit, because Ryan was deeply offended. Some reviewers have criticized me for allowing Ryan to say that he thought the Obama speech that day was demagoguery. Well, the president himself acknowledges that it was a mistake to give that kind of speech with the key Republican like Paul Ryan there, who's chairman of the Budget Committee.
Although demagoguery is a big, really powerful word, and we've been hearing a lot of that kind of thing. You know, what amazes me is how often the Nazis and Hitler are invoked in Washington politics today. It used to be you're a commie. Now you're a Nazi.
Not the key people that I'm writing about. That is not part of the rhetoric. You have to kind of step back from the tree here a little bit and look at the magnificent forest. And what I find distressing is that the coverage of the campaign focuses on the daily food fight polls. There will be a gaffe or a mistake or an alleged mistake, and then people report it intensely, and then they'll take a poll and say, somebody poured garbage on one of the candidates, or, as is often the case, the candidate poured garbage on himself. Mm-hmm. Do you smell anything? And then people say, oh, yeah, I pay attention to the news. I'm a good citizen. And so then polls shift around. I'm not sure what that's measuring. And what we need to report on is what really happened. And I think too often we miss, we run by the history that's right in front of us.
Well, one of the areas that I've often been confused about is just what happened with the Erskine Bowles Alan Simpson Committee. The president didn't publicly embrace the conclusions of that deficit commission, which were released in December 2010, and nobody seemed to really be very pleased by it. What did it call for? Is it a reasonable plan?
Well, it's the framework for a reasonable plan. I asked the president about that a couple of months ago, and he said, it's interesting, for the first time he said he did not endorse Simpson-Bowles because it proposed eliminating or reducing tax deductions for mortgage interest rate, health insurance deduction, and the charitable contribution deduction. And he said that would be wildly unpopular and never pass Congress. I think he's right in the whole, but as part of a negotiation, some sort of tax reform, some of those deductions need to be eliminated, and oddly enough, it's Governor Romney who's proposed reducing them for the high-income people. I think that's inevitable. I think it should happen. But you can't Simpson-Bowles is kind of the Rosetta Stone for lots of people. Ah, this is going to solve everything. Well, it's got a lot of vagueness to it also.
And it disappeared for a while and revived when Paul Ryan criticized the president for it during the Republican National Convention. But that came back to haunt him when it was pointed out that he voted against it.
He did, and as did lots of the Republicans, and their critique was that it would eliminate the health care insurance deduction, which would drive everyone to Obamacare, and of course Ryan doesn't like Obamacare.
After the Gang of Six announced a proposal on July 19th in the middle of the secret negotiations between Obama and John Boehner, the president called a press conference and praised their work. How did that affect what was on the table in the secret negotiations?
Yeah, it's an amazing sequence because out comes the Gang of Six, and it's includes three Republicans, including a Republican senator who's one of John Boehner's most one of his closest friends. And so in the White House, they just seized on this. And again, David Plouffe said, oh, this is an opportunity to give us some maneuvering room. We have to propose more revenue. And the president eventually did, just picking up the phone, making this offer to the speaker. And to this day, they disagree on what happened in that phone call.
Well, members of his caucus, especially the Tea Party members elected in 2010, happy that the speaker was negotiating with the White House?
No. The speaker told me literally that he knew he was taking great risk and that all of his senior staff, the speaker's senior staff, came to him and said one by one, you are risking your speakership by doing this. Don't do it. And Boehner's response to me was, I need to proceed on this. We've got to cut spending. As he said it not so eloquently, I need this job like a hole in the head.
Well, he was criticized by some for backing down because they felt that in the end he wanted to hold on to the job. There's a sort of a he said between John Boehner and President Obama throughout the book. Do you ever feel like you're being used to get each side of the story out?
Well, they give their side, and then there are memos and their contemporaneous notes, and it gets reduced to very little, he said, she said. There is agreement on most of it, and including that phone call, the people in the White House say the president didn't insist on more revenue, but he insisted on some modification of the deal, including on entitlement cuts. So the president was changing and moving the goalposts, as he has denied.
And does Boehner feel that the president didn't understand the position that he was in?
I think that's right. The president told me that he understood it fully, and this is one of the most interesting things about this. President said, I didn't want to do anything to make John Boehner look weak. You know, he's the opponent, the one you're negotiating with, and so he realized that there was a reasonable streak in Boehner, and the president said openly, he said, I think John Boehner wanted a deal.
You conclude that neither President Obama nor John Boehner really handled the situation well and basically kicked the can down the road. Both, you say, are risk-averse. Can't the same thing be said about Washington on the whole these days?
Yes, I agree. And I think it can be said about the press that we're risk-averse because when you get into these things and ask for the details, I got meeting notes and then went to the White House, and the White House didn't want to respond to a lot of this. And I said, look, I've got this. And then they finally opened up, but it takes months of work, and you're never guaranteed. I mean, the risk is they're just going to close you out. And to their credit, they did not. They responded in detail.
The publication of your books always gets Washington talking. Are you ever surprised by which of the anecdotes gets singled out?
Always. You can never tell. I mean, the people have landed on this incident in which Speaker Pelosi pushed the mute button on her telephone, not to mute the president out when he had called in, but to mute out the negotiations that were going on between her and Harry Reid to cut up this magnificent spending pie called the stimulus package. Now, in fairness, she has said, she's kind of denied it. I have witnesses who were there who say that's exactly what happened. Anyone who's been on a conference call where people are talking might mute their own button so they can do other business. It's not particularly unusual. Maybe it's unusual that it happened with the president.
This time, some of your reporting has been used by the Romney campaign in an attack ad.
Yes, that specifically. There's all kinds of information here to criticize both sides. And that is what you do when you occupy that very small zone of neutral reporting.
Just one more question. If the Republicans weren't willing to give the president a victory back in 2011 because of this year's campaign, is there any chance that they'll be more willing to negotiate with Obama if he is reelected?
Let's hope so. This is something that has to be fixed. This is like after 9/11, they decided we needed to make sure that terrorists couldn't come into the United States. Now, that is an almost impossible task, but so far the U.S. government, spending hundreds of billions of dollars, in fact, has succeeded at that. So, you know, government can do hard things. They only do them and they only change when there's a crisis. And we have a looming crisis, and you will, I predict, be talking about it. Others will, and what I've tried to do here is take people and show them what happened for 3.5 years and the exact, Obama's quoted thousands of words that you haven't heard in public, the Republicans thousands of words. You can make your own evaluation.
All of Bob Woodward's previous 16 books have become national bestsellers, and so has this one already. It's called The Price of Politics. It is published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you.